Welcome. I returned a few days ago from a conference of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association of North America, the SZBA. So this is Soto Zen, our lineage. I think I maybe mentioned a couple weeks ago that the founder of this lineage in Japan, Dogen Zenji, didn't like to call it Soto Zen lineage. He just, because he didn't want to be sectarian. But these names are unavoidable. So now we call it Soto Zen, named after these two teachers, Sozan and Tozan from ancient China. So this particular stream of Zen from Japan and China and India, brought to us by Japanese teachers such as Suzuki Roshi in this case, and Kōpin Shino Roshi in Santa Cruz, has spread all over the Western world. And at some point, sometime in the last 10 years, this group formed, the Soto Zen Buddhist Association in America, to get together from all these different Zen centers really all around the country and meet and see if these different groups could support each other in their practice and learn from each other. And I'd heard about it, but I hadn't been to one of these meetings until just last week, and I went with some interest, but not too much interest, you know. But I came away feeling actually very inspired and very glad to have gone, and ready to go again, maybe next time. I think mainly I came away feeling that Soto Zen in America, Zen in America, is alive and well. The practice as presented and lived and practiced by all these teachers from around the country is very encouraging. Partly just that there's so many people doing it now. That this is like second, third generation after the Japanese founders. And there's small groups like this, like Santa Cruz Zen Center, all around the country, trying to find their way and coming to conferences like this to network and see how other people are doing things. And lots of things happened in this, you know, lots of meetings, lots of talking in these 4 days, and teachings going on also. But one of the main themes for discussion is around this issue of standards for training. And in a way, the conference was kind of geared towards priests, Zen priests. Everyone at the conference, I think, was a Soto Zen priest, and there were like 70 of them, which in itself is amazing that there are even 70 Zen priest people giving their lives to the practice in America. And of course, there's many more, hundreds. There are 70 at this meeting. But I think a lot of these discussions about these standards of training could apply to everyone, not just priests, anyone practicing Zen. And it was humbling to be at this meeting too, because I felt like it was my elders in American Zen at this meeting there. I was one of the youngest ones, and people have been practicing there for decades and decades, mostly. A lot of them practiced with those original founders who came in the 60s and 70s. And so what they had to say felt like it had some weight to it. They spoke eloquently and strongly and passionately about their concern and joy about Zen training. And the one person, one of these elders, said she was concerned that as the generations go on in American Zen, the standards tend to get looser, or it's very easy for with people's creativity and just as the teachings and the practice get passed along, gaps appear sometimes, and I felt like she really spoke from her heart, like she, there's something so precious in our practice and tradition of Zen that we don't want to lose. And so she said it's the job of this older generation to make sure that the next generation maintains these standards of practice and keeps the practice going very strongly. And particularly, she was speaking to this older generation. She was saying the next generation, particularly younger people, really need challenge. She's saying it's hard because this first generation of Zen teachers is getting older, and they can't practice maybe as intensively as they did in their youth, and so they're practicing in the way that they can, but then the next group of those in their 20s and 30s coming along with this passion for life and for practice, and let's do it, just, I'm ready to go, just tell me what the practice is, I'll do it, I'll give everything for it, is the spirit of the younger generation. And she says it's hard sometimes for the older generation to instill that sense of noble urgency and passion sometimes to the next generation of younger people. So I don't need to go into all the standards of what were, you know, the specifics of what was talked about. I mean, a lot of it would just apply to priests. But I think everyone agreed that just strong practice based on Zazen is like the essential thing. You know, we have so many aspects of practice, and there's so much creativity in Zen, and it's beautiful how it's spreading out into all these different forms and manifestations. But everybody agreed on, well, it's really, this all springs forth from Zazen practice, our silent, still, upright, sitting meditation, doing nothing, is the basis for all this activity. And so I think about that now, especially here with our, we've just started this fall practice period, where we, it's a chance to see if we can call forth even more commitment to Zazen practice, and as much of the schedule at the Zen Center as we can work into our life. And there's different groups like Santa Cruz Zen Center doing this in so many different ways around the country. A lot of groups have practice periods. You know, practice period originally came from in the monastery. You have a time of usually, traditionally like 3 months where nobody comes and goes, and everybody there who's already living there intensifies their practice, but there's nowhere to go anyway. So it's, in a way, it's much easier because it's just set up for that. You just fall into it and get carried along by the community living together, practicing together. So it's harder, I think, in a place like this to where people have very complex lives, to find a way to somehow in our busy life to come together even more and still maintain this or even increase our practice for a limited time. There's one group in Sacramento that I think they're trying this experiment for the first time. I'm not sure if this is exactly right, but as I remember, something like they're having a 100-day practice period, and they meet less often than we do. We have zazen 5 days a week here, 3 times a day, 5 days a week in Santa Cruz. I think this group only meets once a week. They only have zazen once a week. But they, so the practice commitment is a lot of just at home. People just commit to just in their life and feel supported by each other doing that. And what they've set up is to try to see if people in the practice period commit to 100 hours of zazen for 100 days. So that was a very creative idea. So it's kind of, you know, if you sat every day for an hour, that would fulfill it. And then they also have, you know, weekend retreats and sesshins and longer retreats. So if you missed some days, you could catch up during these retreats and get to 100 days. And I think it's not a matter of like, well, you know, it's a problem if you don't, but it's more like people setting that intention. I thought very creative, just however you can work it into your life. And exploring a little bit into others, small Zen centers like this, it's similar. It looks like people try to encourage like an hour of meditation practice a day, which may seem like a lot. Even here we just have, you know, if you come for one period of zazen, it's just 40 minutes. Maybe we could count that. But every day seems like a lot. But these are for limited times. And I thought, how wonderful, you know, to be able to sit one period of zazen, 40 or 60 minutes a day. And I think people who do that find it very encouraging, like it helps their life. But it's hard, especially on one's own. There's so many things that can come up. So then we have places where we can come and, well, I know there's zazen going on there, so I can come and join it. So that's one idea. We haven't, you know, gotten into that, but I thought I'd just mention it just because there's other groups doing that, and it's a possibility. You can do it even secretly. Just decide. But like for this practice period at Santa Cruz is 10 weeks, so 70 days. And since we're already maybe 10 days into it, you could say, I wonder if it's possible to practice for 60 hours until the close of this practice period. Partly I'm thinking about all these things and I'm looking into other Zen centers because somehow I got put onto one of the many committees of this SEBA called the Standards Committee. So I'm kind of looking into like what are people using as standards and doing, and all these groups are trying various things. So what is it about commitment to some practice? I think that's often the issue. Sometimes maybe even more than the actual meditation itself. It's more like, you know, I might just be asleep through every period of these 70 periods, but or maybe not concentrated at all, but like I'm going to actually stop what I'm doing, sit down. Maybe this would be the criteria for zazen, would be like not doing anything else, just sit in one, you know, posture for that time. And if the phone rings, not answer it. If I feel like, oh, I need to go check something, not checking for that little short time. Of course, again, it's much easier when you're in a hall with a bunch of people. You feel like, well, if I get up, I'll interrupt the silence. Very easy if you're sitting at home to, well, let me just check one thing and then I'll come back. So, but just to commit to coming back again and again to that place of stillness each day. And commitments are dangerous because I was having a conversation today with someone about commitments, and they were saying that they resist making them because they feel like they might not be able to keep them. And then they'll feel bad about themselves. So it's better to not even make them. So this is definitely a danger of making commitments. But that's part of the trick, it seems, is can we make a commitment, an intention to practice some way, take up some practice, but without judging ourselves if we don't fulfill it, just because the very intention of taking something up changes us. And then, if we're not going along with it, maybe nobody else even knows but ourselves, but then we get to watch that mind and watch, well, there was some mind that set it up, and was that a mind that I want to cultivate? Or was it just a game? Sometimes we can do that too. I can set up a game with myself. I'm going to commit to do this so that I'll just feel good about myself. That's another maybe trap of making commitments. I'm going to do this, and then at the end, if I've accomplished this, then I can pat myself on the back and say, that's great, I did it. Which is okay also, but I think there's deeper functions of commitment, just that they lead us in the direction of our deepest, most sincere heart. So, which we have to discern first. What is that that we really want to do? And then making the space to do it. It's very easy when thinking of committing to something to say, well, I actually can't. I have no more time in my day to add 40 minutes of zazen, for example. But I would say there's really no such thing as can't. There's like, it's all a matter of priorities. And everything is possible. A lot of these discussions at this meeting where people were saying, well, we have to have this way because there's certain people who can't do this. And then there were all kinds of discussions, but why can't they, you know? And there's different, you know, different standards for different kinds of commitments too. So, and that's just all a matter of actually what we want to do with our life. And I think it's good to remember, maybe above all, that we are totally free. We're always, nothing is stopping us. When we say, I can't do such and such, it's never really true, right, on the deepest level. I think we all know this. It's more like we're making a decision. I can't do that if I'm doing this, and I'm choosing to do this. But it's never like, I have to do this. I mean, sometimes I'm like, well, I have this job with these hours, and this boss says I have to do this. And those are maybe the hardest things that involve a lot of other people. But even then, we're choosing to be in that situation. But I have to pay the rent or whatever. But we're still choosing. Just remember that we're always choosing. And then we can feel free. Then we can say, actually, I can do that, but I'm consciously choosing to do this. And I think that is the freedom, actually. When we don't feel coerced, actually, into anything in our life, we feel that we're consciously intending to live each moment the way we want. That, you could almost say, that's practice. And that's difficult, right? So often we feel like, well, I'm not actually in control here. There's all these other factors. And of course there are many, many factors of our life. But within that, there's this, we can respond in any possible way within our limited situation. And how do we want to? What is most joyful? I think that's another way of thinking about commitment. Is not like, what should I do? Am I starting to feel guilty that I should be doing more? I should be practicing more or something like that. That's another trap. Another commitment trap is guilt tripping ourselves. But more like trying to discern the bottom of our heart. What do we really want in this short life while we're still alive? How do we really want to live this? And I'm kind of coming at this angle from, say, zazen, because I'm here at a Zen center. But it might not necessarily be zazen. It might be like my true heart in this life is to, I'm a doctor, and I'm going to spend all my time learning how to do that better and help people in that way. But I think if we don't discern it clearly, then we might feel like, well, I'm a doctor, but like, I'm actually working overtime too much. I feel trapped in this position. And then maybe we have to do something about it. But if we discern our deepest intention, then we can live it. And that's, my teacher once said something like that and I've heard elsewhere also, that a basic kind of formula for being happy is discerning what we really want most, our deepest intention, which takes a while maybe to really see what it is. And it's changing too. Everything's impermanent. It might be different than what we think it is just because it's what we said it was last year. It might be different now or different than yesterday. But if once we discern that, find it, and then line up our whole life with that intention. I mean, if you really take this all away, it could be like, you know, every moment of your day would be aligned with this deepest intention. And that even if you don't go with it, even if you're constantly failing, you'll have a very, very happy life. Can you imagine? I think there's something to that, you know. Because it's like we have no doubt about our direction then. I think often we feel split, divided. I kind of want to do this, but I feel trapped over here, and really because I kind of want to do this. And of course, doing lots of different things is what we're always doing. But what is, are they all, can they all be in accord with this deepest, ultimate concern? And, you know, that maybe that Zazen is something about lining up with this. Maybe our deepest concern is living from a place of deep stillness and peace, and then going about our life from that center of stillness. And that Zazen, we know will really help us with that. But if we don't get to that point of discerning that, still, this is a little advertisement for Zazen, that Zazen can help us to discern what we really want, which maybe have nothing to do with Zazen. You know, but it may be like if we just, often people I think find that in the, especially longer retreats, is like their deeper issues of their life come up and they start to see like, wow, I'm actually, what am I doing here? And maybe even that they like may come up with some plan for their next year or something during that retreat, which may be kind of an unconventional thing, but maybe very beneficial. They like discerned some direction to go that fulfills that heart's calling. So I think just that those times of stillness can really help with that. And in Zen too, probably everybody's heard, and I would even venture to say is probably drawn to Zen in particular, I would guess. I know I was one who was drawn because we have these amazing teachings along the lines of the great way is basically perfect and all-pervading. How could it depend on practice and realization? We have these teachings said in many, many ways. This inherent perfection of the universe that I think we know in our hearts. Even if we haven't heard those teachings, I would say anybody who ends up in a room like this, in some part of our deepest heart, we have an intuition that the world of difficulty and day-to-day troubles is a kind of surface world, and there's a deeper view of reality where everything is functioning in perfect harmony all the time. And we hear such things, and then we want to get closer to such a vision and live from such a vision, so then we start practicing Zen or some other practice like this. And the more we open to such teachings, the more we feel like, well, then what's all this issue about, like, things like standards? And, you know, 100 hours of zazen in 100 days, you know, how contrived and extra, how different that sounds than everything is perfect and you can't escape the perfection, which are the deepest teachings of our tradition. And yet somehow these go together, and all the ancient teachers have always presented both sides and woven them together, and when people fall off on one side, they bring up the other side, and when they fall off on that side, they bring up the other side. So if we're like, you know, getting like super neurotic about having to, you know, counting every second of zazen or something, I've known people who try to do this, you know, time of zazen thing. You know, not so much about the quality, but just like, how many minutes can I get? I knew somebody at Tassajara once, he was like, every break, he was like, getting a certain number of hours a day. So even if I get like 3 minutes between, you know, if I go out for a bathroom break, I could get, like, I can log in like 3 minutes of zazen and add it to my time. We can get it like that way, you know. And maybe it's kind of ridiculous. Especially in this vision of like, well, everything's perfect from the start. So, if we get into that mode, we need to remember everything's perfect from the start. But then if we slip into everything's perfect from the start, so, you know, even zazen, even any kind of meditation is kind of extra because it's all really ultimately the same, which is true. Right? But if we fall into holding that side, then we need to, well, even though that's so, I'm still going to just sit here for the next hour. And we have various stories about this, these two sides and the problems of each. Right. Here's one of them. One Zen story. The 61st case of the Blue Cliff Record. Feng Shui's one atom of dust. Feng Shui, giving a talk, said, if you set up a single atom of dust, the nation flourishes. If you do not set up a single atom of dust, the nation perishes. Shui Do, the collector of these stories, raised his staff and said, are there any patchwork monks who will live together and die together with me? And that's the story. A typically enigmatic Zen story. So, another somewhat expanded version says, Feng Shui says, if you set up a single atom of dust, the nation flourishes, and the peasants furrow their brows, and the peasants frown. And if you don't set up a single atom of dust, the nation perishes and the peasants dance and sing. And the old peasants, we could take as an allusion to these old Zen ancestors who have big eyebrows, the furrow. And setting up a speck of dust, atom of dust, is basically doing something in this realm where actually nothing is truly happening. Nothing's ever happened, ultimately, is our deepest view of reality, is that what appears to be the world of happening and standards and zazen and Zen centers and forms and practices actually isn't happening. It's never happened. And so in this realm where nothing's ever happening, to set up, which takes a lot of effort to set up a Zen center, build it, and come up with forms and schedules and ceremonies and standards and practices and practice periods and retreats is not even just setting up an atom of dust. This is like setting up like a huge pile of dust. And if we do that, the nation flourishes. Nation, we could say, is like the realm of society and people and what we can see as the world, the government, the people, the general population flourishes. But those old peasants living out in the mountains, not doing anything all day, they furrow their brows and they say, those silly people setting up a Zen center in the midst of empty space, thinking that there's something to do there and that people should call forth more energy for practice. How could that guy sit up there and talk like that? It's really too bad. And then if we don't set up a speck of dust, if we don't set up a Zen center, if we don't do anything at all, then the nation perishes. The world as we know it, the Buddhas and ancestors, all these stories and collections of Zen stories, experiences of awakening even. You know, because this realm where nothing's happening, experiences of awakening don't happen either. Nothing happens. So all of it drops away, the nation perishes, but those old peasants out in the field, they laugh and sing because they know that there was never anything to be done in the first place. So these two sides, there's one old talk where Suzuki Roshi, Zen Center founder, commented on this story, and he said like setting up the Zen center is like raising a speck of dust, and it's kind of problematic because it's doing a lot of stuff and it's getting all involved, and really Zen centers should, their function should be to make Zen centers useless, and Zen practice should function to make Zen practice obsolete, and the Buddhas should appear in the world to make Buddhas unnecessary. In the end, when we all realize that there's nothing to be done completely to the marrow of our bones, then we can dismantle the Zen center. But until that time, it looks like we need places like this and other practices. And it looks like these ancients, even though it seems like they often deeply understood there was nothing to be done, they seem to set up such places. And even to the point of like ridiculousness sometimes, how much they would engage and in the practice of Zazen and Zen life, throwing away all the things that they could be doing for the sake of what? So these cases always have a verse celebrating the story. And Shui Do, the collector, writes this verse. Interestingly, I thought, in this case, he says, "The old peasants may not unfurrow their brows, but for now I hope that the nation establishes a sturdy foundation. Crafty ministers and valiant generals, where are they now? 10,000 miles pure wind, only oneself knows." So he only takes up one side of this raising or not raising the speck of dust, he says, which I found a little surprising myself. This is, the old peasants may not unfurrow their brows. They're going to have problems with this. But for now, I hope that the nation establishes a sturdy foundation. I hope that the Zen centers have strong standards and strong practice. Yeah. The crafty ministers, kind of conniving tricksters who get people to like do this Zen practice where nothing needs to be done. Where are these people now? We need them to convince people to do something that doesn't need to be done. They need to be pretty crafty. And then in the end, he does mention this other side is at the same time 10,000 miles pure wind. Only one self knows. We could say, like, even in the midst of this, even in the midst of being crafty and tricky and sneaky, getting people to like sit down and do nothing when they could be accomplishing something with their life. How ridiculous that is, and still in the midst of that, there's this 10,000 miles of pure wind that each person, right in the midst of, well, I guess it's time for Zazen again today, let me try to stay awake, somewhere in the back of that mind is this 10,000 miles of pure wind that one knows oneself at that time, and then we go about our busy life again. Are there any patro monks, are there any practitioners who will live together and die together with me? Also, it seems sort of the same side. There's nothing to be done, but who wants to come together in Sangha and live together and die together during this very strange and seemingly useless practice? Who will come forward and commit to such an absurd thing? So there's these two sides, and particularly this side of standards and practices. And I wonder how it is for people. It would be great to hear from you all and here, especially if it feels like you have some question about the what is the function of this commitment, and how do I make it, and is it worth it, or especially making all the old peasants frown, is it really worth it then? Or anything else you'd like to bring up about the practice and the teaching. Yes, Michael.
You're talking about two sides and duality, and yet we, in practice, talk about not two but one, non-duality. So I'm wondering how the story says, here's a duality, how do you make them one?
Yeah, it brings up the two sides, and yet that's a great question. And it seems like the non-duality is our life, is the expression of our practice. It's and the spirit of committing to come to Zazen and keep standards and forms and all these contrivances. Our spirit in doing that is of raising all that dust, is in the midst of raising all the dust, we're not really raising any dust. And then we might start wondering, well, how do we do that? It still seems like we're raising dust. But another way to say it, maybe more simply, is like just doing it. Just raising dust with no ulterior motives, no motives at all, just wholeheartedly raising dust in the form of, often we say, just sitting, and this is the spirit of our meditation practice too, is we say just wholeheartedly sitting means like keeping this particular form. We have all this emphasis on the posture and how we bow and all these different things, and yet in the spirit of, we're not actually doing anything, and it's not about any goal in the future. It's an expression of thoughtlessness.
I would think it's also making a commitment, whether to make dust or not make dust. There's the commitment that you make to the practice.
Yeah, and even the commitment itself, it, which seems like very dusty, is a very dusty commitment. Is, you know, in terms of this story, is just a kind of a dusty phenomenon. It's kind of dirty. It's like the ancestors would talk about going into the mud to help all beings, which is another important part here too. It's like we're raising the dust out of compassion. We set up Zen centers to help others, even though there's no others and no help. We set it up. And the commitment itself is, you know, it's somewhat contrived, that's the dusty part, and yet it itself is free of dust. At the same time, it's not really happening the way we think. This discussion about commitment that I had earlier today, someone was asking about, well, I feel like whenever I get into that, it's like me making this intention. And I feel like there's all this me around it, and that feels like kind of extra and not so great. And we were exploring how, actually, on the deepest level, we don't make commitments. Commitments arise. And I was encouraging the practice of, instead of, like I mentioned earlier, instead of thinking, what should I do? Maybe I should make a deeper commitment. To actually just discern this deepest heart of intention, what we really want most, and then watch the commitment that naturally arises from that. But I think because we're human, that does happen, and then we forget again. And then we're like, suddenly, like, we've committed to, say, come to Zazen, and now we're really tired, and it's like, why did I make that? It was just a contrived thing. I don't need to do that now. And like, we've lost the original spirit that it came from. So that's why over and over again, and like Shwedo says, for now, let's set up a big pile of dust. You know, make the commitments. And until we get to the point where it's just all naturally happening. And there's no self-concern one way or the other. I don't know if that answered the question. It was kind of roundabout. But something along there. But I think that that's a wonderful thing to keep exploring too, these two sides, and then seeing how they are conjoined every moment in our practice, actually. We may not be able to see that, but to open to it more and more, how in the very midst of our, let's see, what kind of schedule can we make? We're planning the next year's calendar right now. Like, how should we set this up? It seems so like, my mind is gonna getting tired just thinking about it. And yet, right in the midst of that, actually, there's the freedom that everything is just arising as it is, according to conditions. That's the reason that we don't make our own intentions and commitments. They arise due to conditions. And if we're tuned in to our deepest intention, then those conditions are going to be most clear at that time, so that the commitments will arise naturally. But this is hard. Yes?
Raising dust. Yeah. I've often wondered why we have the standard of 40 minutes. Why? Where did it come from?
It's a dusty standard.
It's a dusty standard.
Very ancient, and probably even before time was divided into minutes. But I've heard one story that originally meditation periods in old China, in Zen, were timed by sticks of incense, which were probably a standard length, or different temples maybe had different lengths, and you just put it in there, and when it burns down, gets down to the bottom, And actually, our sticks of incense are, the ones we use, I think, are almost exactly 40 minutes, coincidentally. They're exactly 40 minutes. Well, there you go.
Including one allows for the part that gets stuck into the ash that doesn't burn.
Now, which came first, the 40 minutes or the incense? That's the question. Was the incense made for Zen periods?
Before there were timepieces called clocks, there were incense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I did hear that science actually found out meditation experiments that 40 minutes makes a change on your brain.
Hmm.
The whole 40 minutes is not impacting your brain as strongly. But after 40 minutes, there's something calming or whatever happens.
Interesting. It is true that often I find, sometimes anyway, the last 10 minutes of Zazen are like when really starting to settle in. And if it ended at 30 minutes, it'd be like, not quite the same. But 40 minutes does seem to be kind of, in Soto Zen, pretty standard time across the board. Like Rinzai Zen, for example, tends to have shorter periods, sometimes like 25 minutes, which is a kind of faster paced practice. Like their walking meditation is much faster too. So everything is more like maybe just packing more in. And it's very focused, say, on koan, during meditation. So I've heard some teachers say meditate for very short times or else you'll lose concentration. In the Dzogchen tradition in Tibet too, they often say meditate for really short periods. There's one teacher retreat I was on where he'd say just like 5 minutes and like, okay, stop. Even if you're starting to get deeper, stop, because you'll start to lose the strong concentration. And then some people go for hours and hours. Maybe Theravada tradition is more like you could, like, 3 hours at a time or something. So, yeah.
But then why do we do 30 minutes sometimes? I don't think there's a standard. Sacramento is
telling me. It doesn't have to be 40, but I think these days they're generally 40 minutes at Santa Cruz. But yeah, it doesn't need to be.
I would respond that in part we're adjusting to life in the marketplace world. You know, like when we run a day sit, it's meant to be encouraging. So, you know, 40 minutes might feel a little too strenuous to a beginning student. And so we might shrink it to 30 minutes for a while until the stamina is built up, and then 40 minutes doesn't feel so long.
So giving them hope.
A hopeless kind of hope, because there is really nothing to rely on. But it is meant to be encouraging and accommodating to, we're not a residential practice place. We're not 21-year-old Japanese men, and we accommodate to the needs of life in the community. It's a variable standard. But when we know we're walking in the door for a 30-minute period, that 30-minute period is the standard for that period.
Yeah, I think the important thing about standards is in a group situation, is we have one chant that says, don't make up standards on your own. And I think that's group Zen practice is very much like that. It's like, well, whatever my preference for 30 or 40, like this time the schedule says this. So we just go along with that. That's the beauty of group practice. It's hard to do that at home because you might say, oh, I'm going to sit 40 minutes, but then it gets to be 30. I'm like, well, that's enough. Or vice versa. You set up 30, but then like, well, I'll just keep sitting. But sometimes it's hard for people to stop, you know, if they're really into it and the bell rings. Certain times it might be just as hard to stop as it is to, like, keep going in another situation. So that's the beauty of group practice, is we just surrender our own ideas and go along with. Oh, and I also wanted to mention on our survey, we just compiled results of the survey. Thank you very much, Jean, and others who helped with that. We did a Sangha survey about what people would like to see in the practice. And I think there was one comment about, it would be nice if the retreats didn't start so early and go so late. Like, say they start after breakfast and go till dinner with the beginning and end of the day. Not like that. Or they're too long, you know, we're having more like 5-day ones now instead of weekend ones that we used to have. It seemed like, I thought maybe that this was really clear, but just to emphasize the point, when we were this experiment of doing informal sesshins, we've been calling them, are serving this very function. But maybe when people see, oh, it's informal, but it's 5 days, I'm not even going to look at what that is because it's too much. But the informal style, as we have been doing, means that just that you can come at any time, so you could decide. I think somebody even was saying, I'd like to be able to personalize my practice more. And that's the function of these. They have their problems too, because we can personalize it so much that we don't come up against our edges. But I think they have this, the beauty of these types of retreats is that you can do 1 day, or you can do like 3 periods, or you can do a half day. And maybe it's hard if it says 1 full day, or it says 5 full days, and people maybe feel like, well, I should be doing more. But I don't know if people think that way. But just to know as the practice period goes on, when we have these informal retreats, that they're really completely open for this very reason, that you can come late, you can leave early, and there'll just be zazen container happening. There will be timed periods with certain lengths of incense and things, but that's one way to kind of have both, in a way that's both sides. It has the more formless, anything is okay, and it has, there's this container that is offered if we want to do more. Yes?
I'm thinking about making a commitment. I was noticing lately that thinking about sitting daily and trying to encourage myself to sit daily, I felt really encouraged if I just thought of somebody else with a really strong practice, like hearing a teacher talk about Suzuchi Roshi's practice of sitting daily, or just thinking about somebody that I know is just has that ease of just no hesitation, just sitting every day. And so it's funny somehow. You know, just easier to drop my own personality stuff by literally imagining another person. You know, just identifying with their ease or their commitment, or maybe more of a universalistic kind of thing, like that is there in the human heart, you know, and there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yes. So now it's time for the form of tea. The structured commitment to tea drinking. Thank you for coming out on a night like this and joining the Sangha. Playing around the dust with me. We dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the complete dustless freedom for all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to rend them. Dharma days are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.